Hallelujah.
Law and Grace, Chapter 12, Part B. What the Law Could Not Do. Subheading, Sojourn and Rest. The law was given in the wilderness. This was in itself a fact of the greatest import. If a man understood, as he was meant to understand, that his wilderness journey was but a parable of his earthly life as a whole, then he would come to view the future rest in Canaan properly, regarding it as but a parable in its turn of the life to come. How significant in the light of that fact would be two outstanding historical events become for him. Firstly, the death of the 10 spies and their supporters in the wilderness. And secondly, the death of Moses before the entry into the land. The 10 spies brought back an evil report of the promised land. For Caleb and Joshua, the fact that it was the promised land was sufficient. What God had promised he was able also to perform, and moreover, would perform. Let us go up at once, then, said Caleb, and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. The people preferred the prospect of returning to Egypt. Caleb and Joshua expostulated with them, If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. But the congregation merely bade stone them with stones. For this, God, in his anger, wished to disinherit the entire nation. But Moses successfully interceded, appealing to God to be true to himself as revealed in the covenant name, saying, Pardon, I pray thee, iniquity of this people, according unto the greatness of thy mercy, and according as thou hast forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. God made a most significant reply to his plea. The people would indeed enter the land, but not those who had chosen to doubt the divine promise. And moreover, the intimation was given that the fulfillment of that promise would be but the harbinger of that time of worldwide rest envisaged in the covenant to the fathers. I have pardoned according to thy word, but in very deed, as I live, and as all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen all my glory and my signs which I wrought in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have tempted me these 10 times and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that despised me see it. In pointed contrast to this sentence of exclusion, there came next the gracious promise to Caleb, They shall not see the land, God had said of the rebels, but my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him and hath followed me fully, him will I bring into the land wherein he went, and his seed shall possess it. We note the reason for this distinction. He, Caleb, had another spirit in him. How had he shown it? By taking God at his word, saying, He will bring us into this land and give it us. God himself would do what they, as men, were powerless to do, and the land would become theirs as a gift from him. And there lay the secret of Caleb's blessing. His faith. He realized the tenancy of the land to be a gift, not a right, a boon of the first covenant, not the second. But as for the faithless, their doom was Surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers. Now, if this was the principle which held good in the case of the physical and material inheritance, how much more was it valid for the eternal rest which this foreshadowed? Faith it was, not human merit or prowess, which would bring them to it. And the proof lay in the heavy sentence of exclusion from the earthly inheritance passed upon the unbelieving. The great principle established in the exclusion of these faithless men from the promised land emerged in sharper form still in connection with the death of Moses. He too failed to enter, with the effect that his death on the very confines of the land resulted in the people's entry not under his own leadership, but under that of his successor, Joshua, instead. This was no freak of history which chanced perversely to frustrate his dearest wish of taking Israel into their inheritance. Far from it. Though when he died, he was 120 years old, yet his eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. That is, an untimely death excluded him from the land, because God decreed that it should. He himself knew that it would, as he pathetically stated to the people, "I besought the Lord, saying, I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain and Lebanon. But the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes, and would not hear me. And the Lord said unto me, Let it suffice thee. Speak no more unto me of this matter, but charge Joshua, and encourage him, and strengthen him, for he shall go over before this people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which thou shalt see." This was no act of caprice on God's part, but one charged with the greatest import. It was not only Moses, the man, who died on Pisgah, but, this being the fact of greatest importance, also Moses, the lawgiver. He, who as mediator of the law, was so much the symbol and embodiment of it that his own name came to attach itself to it, though it was in reality the law of God himself. When he failed to take the people into the material rest, so also simultaneously did the law. And this, in allegory, taught that into the eternal rest also, of which the land was but a symbol, the law was likewise incapable of taking men. Not, however, because it chanced that men robbed of its power to do so because they failed to keep it. No, not for that reason, but rather because God decreed that it should not, as he decreed that Moses should not lead the people in, because the law never possessed and was never meant to possess the power to do so in the first place. Not Moses, but Joshua was the appointed agent. Not the law, that is, but that scheme of salvation realized in him, Jesus, who bore the same name as his illustrious predecessor. Thus, as God purposed, Israel entered the earthly rest. The problem now was both how to teach them that it was not the true rest which God purposed for his people, and also to keep alive in their hearts the realization that as the law had failed to give them the material rest, so also was it incapable of giving them the eternal rest of the age to come. The law resolved this problem neatly. It decreed the land to be God's exclusive possession, let out in lots on leasehold to every man with an inheritance in it, and thus let out on leasehold equally to any man to whom he sold it. For 49 years only could any but the lawful tenant retain the land which he had bought. And when he bought it, he did so on the fundamental condition that it could be redeemed at any time. That is, rights in the land were really rights in its products only. The land, as land, remained God's. Hence the decree, the land shall not be sold forever, that is, in perpetuity, for the land is mine. If sold, it automatically reverted in the great sabbatical year of Jubilee to its rightful tenant, whose inheritance it was. Ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. Shall be a jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family. It was like the occupation of Canaan all over again. It even brought release to the slave in the same way as the occupation had completed the release of those redeemed from slavery in Egypt. Coming, however, as it did only once in the adult life of the average man and woman, it must have seemed, when it did come, like the advent of the final rest. But alas, with the passing of this year, all reverted to normal, and in the course of history, one jubilee succeeded another, as day succeeded day and year succeeded year, with the final release still far away in the future. The law arranged for the Jubilee and thereby most effectively turned the Israelites' gaze toward that final release. But again, it was powerless to bring it to pass. Israel, as it were, even in the land, were still in the wilderness. And the law partook of the same temporal character as Israel's wanderings there. And to this the law itself in the Jubilee regulations gave its frank assent. The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, for ye are strangers and sojourners with me. Israel, dwellers in the land, yet strangers and sojourners still. And it was the law that said it. This could only mean that Israel, though in possession of the material rest, were actually still journeying toward the true rest, as their fathers had journeyed toward their earthly inheritance when traveling through the literal wilderness, and this in turn signified that as the lawgiver had failed to bring the fathers into the one, so the law would fail to bring each subsequent generation into the other. To give men eternal inheritance was not in its power. Small wonder that all its teaching devices were carnal ordinances. Temporal and transient itself, it could not logically use anything as a symbol which was not equally temporal and transient. It was for this reason, therefore, that it made the physical and material the emblems of the ethical and spiritual, and in the process confessed its impotence to give men that eternal salvation to which it pointed in its symbolism. In its ritual, that confession was not only implicit, but on occasions also explicit. The distinction between the two varieties of sin offering is a case in point. The blood of the bullock offered for the high priest or nation was brought into the holy place, that is, into that division of the tabernacle which typified mortal fellowship with God. But its carcass was burnt without the camp, and the priests were categorically forbidden to eat it. They could eat the flesh only of the goats or sheep whose blood was placed on the horns of the altar. An arrangement like the latter was clearly essential to the successful education of Israel by the law in matters affecting sin and its expiation. But an arrangement like the former was also essential in order that the law should also give silent witness to the fact that it could not actually bring man into fellowship with God. The two varieties of sin offering, in fact, conspired together to make that clear. The blood of the sin offering, which could be eaten, proceeded no further than the court. That division of the sanctuary which typified Israel as seeking reconciliation. While the bullock whose blood made reconciliation in the holy place, that division of the tabernacle which typified Israel enjoying fellowship with God, symbolized an atoning offering which was in reality distinct from the Mosaic system, since it was burnt outside the camp, and so fell outside that system. The camp was primarily a symbol of Israel as the holy covenant people, but owing its existence and constitution solely to the law, it also served as a type of the Mosaic system as a whole. Moreover, the blood of the bullock proceeded no further than the veil. Everything pertaining to the law, for the ritual of the bullock remained part of the law as such, even though it witnessed to the inefficacy of the law. In fact, stopped short at the veil. When we recall that the veil separated the most holy place from the holy place, and recall that the most holy place symbolized eternal fellowship with God, we see why this was. It signified that the law could not transcend the limits of this mortal life. It could not relate men to immortality. At first sight, the ritual of the Day of Atonement would seem to contradict this fact, for on that day, the blood of the bullock and goat of sin offering was in fact brought into the most holy place. That is true, but it in no way invalidates our conclusions, for the one who brought it in, though he had perforce to be a priest, did not act as a typical Levitical priest on this occasion, for he went in divested of his ordinary insignia of office. He put off his distinctive vestments and donned special holy garments in their place, to stress that it was not the law as administered by its appointed priesthood which effected access into the eternal state which the most holy place symbolized, but another system of reconciliation altogether. And to bring this home more forcefully still, the law went to the extent of excluding the whole of the rest of the priesthood from the tabernacle while the high priest penetrated into the innermost sanctuary. There shall be no man in the tabernacle of the congregation when he goeth in to make an atonement in the holy place. No man, said the law. The choice of word is significant. Man is mortal. The most holy place typified immortality, so that whenever man as such was in the tabernacle, the veil, as a symbol of the flesh, had to stand as a barrier before him, saying, thus far and no further. Who then was the officiating priest who could proceed beyond the veil? A man, truly, but clearly something more than man, as all with eyes to see would perceive. The red heifer. There was always the danger that the majority of Israelites would fail to perceive the significance of the ritual of the Day of Atonement. They might be blinded to it by the very fact that the ritual was, after all, an integral part of the law as a system and enacted in the tabernacle, which was in itself essential to the worship which the law prescribed. To ensure that they would not be missed the lessons of that day, and so their witness to the intrinsic inability of the law to relate men to eternal life, clearly needed careful underlining. This they received in the ritual of the red heifer. Everything connected with this took place outside the camp. Nothing could more unmistakably witness to the fact that, though it was again the law which prescribed the ritual, the things of which it spoke belonged to a system altogether separate and distinct from the law itself. And this was the fundamental lesson which the law intended here to be understood. So, footnote here. It is also most significant that though all other sacrifices presented at the sanctuary were burnt there upon the altar in the very heart of the camp, yet their ashes had regularly to be borne away to a site outside the camp. A telling token, they were nothing more than a ritual foreshadowing of a different means of atonement, which would be independent of the law itself. We now see why this was necessary, and we see it all the more clearly because we have already found the law to be a system which could kill but was never meant to make alive. The ritual of the red heifer was prescribed for a man who was defiled by the dead, and thereby ritually a dead man, compare with the leper. Such a man was thus pronounced technically dead by the law itself, and fittingly so, for the law brought him under literal sentence of death in its outworking in his experience. His defilement, however, was ritual, not real, ceremonial rather than actual, which probably explains why a female was prescribed as a cleansing offering. An ewe lamb was similarly the sin offering prescribed for the healed leper. Being a female, it was fittingly a virgin, and in conformity with the fact, had not to have come under the yoke like the heifer prescribed for the ritual of cleansing from murder. This animal, however, unlike the other, was a sacrifice, That emerges clearly from the fact that it had to be killed sacrificially and its blood to be sprinkled directly before the tabernacle of the congregation seven times. Consequently, unlike the heifer of Deuteronomy 21, it had compulsorily to be without blemish. Once atoning power had been communicated to the blood, and so to the animal, by the sprinkling, the entire carcass, her skin and her flesh and her blood with her dung, had to be burnt to ashes. And the priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet and cast it into the midst of the burning of the heifer. The cedar wood spoke of freedom from corruption, the hyssop of cleansing, the scarlet of healing, as in the case of the leper's purification. And they thus indicated what would be the character of the potency possessed by the animal's ashes. These would restore life to the dead. This fact may explain why the heifer had to be red, for redness can connote health and life. And as the animal's other three characteristics, virginity, freedom from blemish, and exemption from the yoke, were necessary to qualify it to be a healing sacrifice, so presumably was its colour also. The defiled man whom it was intended to cleanse was symbolically a corpse, and no contrast could be sharper than that between the ruddy hue of the heifer and the pallor of a dead face. Indeed, even the animal's sex may have been intended to be suggested of life, since the female is the life producer in all nature. The ashes were laid up in a clean place and were for a water of impurity, according to the Revised Version margin. That is, they were intended for the removal of impurity, as the sin offering was for the removal of sin, and could effect that removal when they had communicated their sacrificial potency to running, that is, living water, by being mixed with it in a dish. To mingle them with stagnant water would, of course, have marred the type of restoring life to the dead. The water had thus of necessity to be living water. In a sense, all the congregation was related to death potentially, so the heifer was presented by and thus on behalf of the children of Israel in the Mass. When contact defiled him, however, a man realized that his relation to death was not only potential but real. So the general efficacy of the water had to be communicated to him individually by his submitting to the prescribed cleansing ritual on the third and the last of his days of separation outside the camp. The minutest contact with death sufficed to communicate its defilement, whether with a corpse, a human bone, or a human grave. Even tents, clothing, and furniture had to be cleansed in the same way as a man or woman. The law was categorical. Whosoever toucheth the dead body of any man that is dead, and purifieth not himself, defileth the tabernacle of the Lord, and that soul shall be cut off from Israel. Indeed, so far reaching were the effects of death to be, that all who handled the ashes, though they had to be clean to qualify to do so, incurred uncleanness for one day in the process. Even the man who sprinkled the water upon another with hyssop, palpably here again a symbol of purification, was thereby made unclean. In the same way as the conduct of the ritual outside the camp bore witness to the fact that a system other than the law was needed to effect the removal of death, so this intimated that it could not be removed apart from a submission to its defilement by whatever would remove it in that other system. That is, only one who was himself subject to death would be able to remove death. The fading glory. The law could not give life. And as we have now abundantly shown, itself admitted this unequivocally. It was, in fact, as transient as those upon whom it was imposed. Moses knew that. God revealed to him that another prophet would arise like him in that he was a prophet, yet greater than he in that his words would be authoritative and final, so much so that to spurn them would spell death to men. Moses in turn communicated this fact to the people in parabolic fashion at the very time when the law was first given. Descended from Sinai, he startled the people by the luster of his face. And when he came down from the mount, the very embodiment of the law itself, as he carried the two tables of stone, he wist not that the skin of his face shone by reason of his speaking with him. And Aaron and the people shrank back in fear. The law indeed was glorious. The shining of his face, being that of the lawgiver, was proof of the fact. But its glory was merely a derived and reflected glory, not intrinsic, but only caught from the source of glory. In the mount, Moses called back his terrified brethren, doubtless reassuring them that they need fear no harm. Stifling their fears, they responded, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned unto him, and Moses talked with them. And during this interview, we note his shining countenance would all the while be exposed to their gaze. And afterward all the children of Israel came nigh, and he gave them in commandment all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. This time, not a select company as before, but the whole congregation had the opportunity of observing the radiance of his face from close at hand. But his communing with them over, he then proceeded to do a strange thing. When Moses had done speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. Many must have been those who pondered the meaning of this puzzling act. But we read of none requesting Moses to reveal its meaning, though doubtless he would have explained it to any who inquired sincerely. They were relieved that his action had concealed the frightening luster of his face and were content with that. For some period afterwards, the strange events of this day were reenacted from time to time, Ordinarily, Moses continued to wear the veil, but we read, when Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he took the veil off until he came out and spake unto the children of Israel that which he was commanded. Again, as he spoke to them, his face was bare as at the first, and once more the children of Israel saw the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone. But again, too, as soon as the interview was over, Moses put the veil upon his face again until he went in to speak with him. Moses probably communed with God on these significant occasions in the temporary tabernacle, Exodus 33. And there God spoke to him face to face, probably only until such time as the sanctuary had been built and consecrated, giving him in the meantime all the guidance necessary for its construction and for the oversight of the people. It is clear that all that the Israelites saw was Moses emerge from the interior of the tabernacle with his face bare and once more lustrous. That his face was bare was evidence that he had taken off the veil upon turning in to commune with God. But had they been able to see him take it off, they would have observed that by this time his face no longer shone. Its glory, symbolic of the glory of the law, had faded. This fact, however, never obtruded itself upon their notice. What impressed them was the fact that his face was always lustrous upon his emergence from the presence of God. And so it continued to be while he communicated to them the substance of the divine message which he had received. This done, Moses on each occasion then put on the veil once more, and once more, all be known to his brethren, the glory faded. In all this, Moses, like the law of which he was here the personification, concealed truth in the very process of revealing it. The whole procedure was allegorically prophetic. It signified that the people would be so dazzled by the law that they would come to regard it as sufficient in itself and an end in itself. It was, however, only a means, a distinctly temporary means to a yet more glorious end. The fading of the glory of Moses' face was indicative of the transience of the law itself. Like all its institutions, it was temporal and destined to pass away with the coming of the one who would do what the law was intrinsically incapable of doing, bring life and immortality to light for perishing sinners.